Coming up on the Down East Journal, Eastern North Carolina has its own flavor.
Best hands down in North Carolina. Yes, we made the trip over here just to eat here today. And of course, you can see what the line is.
We visit some popular local Q destinations here in Eastern North Carolina.
And it's cooked all night. And so that's an 18-hour process for you to be able to hold a pork sandwich in your hand.
And heading into June 7th, a primer on the primary.
The public is not as aware as they could be. So what we're doing to combat that is using social media, doing just about everything we can.
And what to look for in the Carolina skies.
Mars has just reached opposition on May 22nd, which means it's now in its closest position for viewing.
Those stories and more just ahead, right after the news. When you think of things that define Eastern North Carolina, you may say our Civil War history or uncrowded beaches, but nothing is more distinctive than our own flavor of barbecue. Really, it's about the sauce. The western part of the state often touts their tomato-based concoction, but here in Eastern North Carolina, it's the tangy, spicy, vinegar-based sauce that's instantly recognized as our spin on barbecue. Some say the tradition dates back to natives of the West Indies slowly roasting meat over coals. Others believe Native Americans used a similar technique. Either way, the recipe has changed very little over the centuries as it's been passed down from generation to generation. Last week, I hit the road to visit some places here in Eastern North Carolina serving old-fashioned vinegar-based barbecue. My first stop, Bee's Barbecue, on the outskirts of Greenville. It's on NC-43, across from a cornfield. The nondescript brick building with a weathered white facade and faded blue awning has a blue Pepsi Cola sign emblazoned with Bee's Barbecue, born in Eastern North Carolina. It would be easy to drive right by, except for the stream of traffic turning off the highway. Cars line both sides of the street, and parking is hard to find. It's the lunchtime rush, and Bee's Barbecue is bustling.
It seemed like it's the flavor that I grew up on, home cooked.
Felicia Boddy has been coming to Bee's for years. Today, she's brought along her sister, Beverly Johnson.
It's your first time coming
here? First time. I just moved here from Maryland.
What have you heard about Bee's Barbecue?
It's the best. It must be the best. They have a road named after it.
Felicia and Beverly join the mob of people standing at the sliding glass window carved into the side of the building where orders are placed if you're going to be eating outside. There's also seating indoors. It's a no-frills eating establishment that sticks with tradition. Whole hog, wood smoked, and vinegar sauce. That keeps customers like Eugene Richardson coming back for more.
Best hands down in North Carolina. Yes, we made the trip over here just to eat here today.
Is it always like this?
Always. They only open, they're going to sell what they have already cooked, and then they're closing for the day. The guy told me, said they won't be much longer. They're going to sell out real soon.
And that's the way it works at Bee's Barbecue. First come, first served.
Yeah, barbecue sandwich and a half an order of corn steaks.
About a dozen people are camped out at picnic tables in the shade of a large oak devouring barbecue. I find a place at a picnic table across from John Radford of Pactolus. He's been coming to Bee's Barbecue since they opened in the late 1970s.
I came here when it was just a country store. I used to walk over here. I lived down the road and watched the snakes crawl across the creek down here before I got here.
Bee's Barbecue has been serving Pitt County and the surrounding area for more than 40 years, and now the joint is experiencing even more recognition as a nominee for the best barbecue sandwich in North Carolina. It's also a stop on the North Carolina Historic Barbecue Trail, which features 23 barbecue pits across the state. My next stop is about a half hour away in the town of Aden. It's hard to miss the Skylight Inn between the large billboard in front and a replica of the Capitol Building's rotunda on top of the restaurant. Manager and co-owner of Skylight Inn, Sam Jones, says the restaurant was opened by his grandfather, Pete Jones, in 1947.
At that time, him and my dad had this idea that, hey, these folks said that this was the best barbecue in America, and we're going to, pun intended, capitalize on that.
The Skylight Inn started as Pete Jones Barbecue, a small building with no air conditioning serving hamburgers, hot dogs, and beer. But Jones says Eastern North Carolina barbecue was always a part of his family legacy.
Probably the 60s was when it transitioned to only doing whole hog barbecue, and that was it, exclusive pork. And I had always served barbecue, several generations back in our family had barbecue joints.
Now, Sam carries on the tradition of slow-cooked, whole-hog, wood-smoked barbecue.
It starts with fresh meat, building a fire. This chimney that we're standing in front of right now is causing us to sweat.
Yeah.
that is the heat source that fuels our fires, literally. And so our meat's put on mid-afternoon, and it's cooked all night. And so that's a 18-hour process for you to be able to hold a pork sandwich in your hand.
It's about 1:30 now, but people are still coming and going. Beverly Johnson is originally from Kinston, but now lives in Norfolk, Virginia. She comes to Skylight Inn every couple of months to get a taste of home.
Well, I think I've converted quite a few Virginians to what real barbecue is now. So whenever I come home, they say, hey, are you going to stop and bring some of that good barbecue back? So, yeah.
You're a barbecue evangelist.
Yes, definitely. Definitely. And a snob.
All right. Well, thanks so much.
Barbecue enthusiast Jack Macy is in the parking lot snapping a photo of the Skylight Inn's rotunda. It's his first stop on the North Carolina Historic Barbecue Trail.
Oh, I ate just a little bit ago.
Oh, did you? Tell me about it.
It was real good. Got real good smoke flavor. Got a real good pork flavor. Got some of the skin in there, a little crunchy skin.
Texture is one of the things manager Sam Jones says makes their barbecue stand out.
We blister the skin on the animal, and we chop that real finely into the meat. And I call them little flavor explosions. And it's a love it or hate it. There's no middle ground. Either you really, really like it, or you really, really think it's terrible.
Inside the Skylight Inn, a line meanders around tables from the order counter to the back of the restaurant. A worker wielding two meat cleavers chops the barbecue as other workers busily pack barbecue into red and white checkered serving trays, add a slice of cornbread, and top it off with a heap of coleslaw.
I think some people in Eastern North Carolina take it for granted, but we're spoiled to an extent. Because at one time there was tons of barbecue places that cooked whole hog barbecue over wood, and as time continues to go on, it seems like that population's shrinking.
While some restaurants focus on preserving the historical traditions of cooking barbecue, others want to emphasize flavor, particularly with the addition of the classic Eastern North Carolina vinegar pepper sauce. That leads me to my next stop. Ask someone where they go for barbecue in Kinston, and most likely they'll tell you.
Kings. Always Kings. Eating here all my life.
That's Bobby Edwards from New Bern. He was in town today and made a detour for Kings.
Most time the barbecue is, moist and good. I ate barbecue out of places, but it's just something about the barbecue brings me back where they make it.
Kings continues many of the traditional methods of cooking Eastern North Carolina-style barbecue, slow-cooked whole hog and hand-chopped. But CEO and President Joseph Hargett says what makes their barbecue stand out is the sauce.
It's got a lot of spices in it. Our barbecue sauce has a lot more spices in it than most people's does. We have about 10 different ingredients go inside of it. But it is still transparent.
It's probably a secret recipe, but can you kind of give us an idea of some of the ingredients that you put in your sauce?
We put A1 steak sauce in it. That's the only ingredient you're getting out of me. And vinegar.
Even though there are certain guidelines to cooking authentic Eastern North Carolina barbecue, it seems each place I visited had their own unique flavor. For some, it's the sauce. For others, it's about texture. And there seems to be as many different ways to prepare barbecue as there are loyal fans who are willing to indulge in the Eastern North Carolina delicacy and help keep the tradition alive. If you want to explore Eastern North Carolina and visit some of the locations on the historic barbecue trail, which also includes stops at Wilbur's Barbecue in Goldsboro and Grady's Barbecue in Dudley, go to ncbbqsociety.com. Most primaries for the 2016 election took place nearly 3 months ago, but true to the election's unorthodox form, primaries for U.S. House, among others, were delayed due to a change in congressional district maps. It gave campaign staffers and their candidates extra time to get the word out and make their case for their respective offices. Chris Thomas spoke to candidates and party leaders in the new 3rd District, which includes Lenore, Onslow, and Craven counties, about the June 7th primary.
Okay, let's review. On February 5th, a 3-judge panel ruled 2 of North Carolina's U.S. House districts were in violation of the Civil Rights Act because they relied too heavily on race.
So their order was to redraw those congressional districts, and they indicated that we could not hold elections for Congress until there was a new plan in place.
Josh Lawson of the North Carolina Board of Elections.
And that resulted in a redrawing of all the congressional districts throughout the state. So not just those two or just the surrounding area, but all of the congressional districts.
Later that month, the General Assembly presented a new map with more compact district lines. The new map, like the old, was contested in court.
So if the current new districts are put into effect, then there will be a separate election on June 7th.
The new districts are in effect, though, making June 7 Primary Election Day Part 2 in North Carolina. Races for U.S. House and Senate Supreme Court judges will come into clearer view after most primaries, including president and governor, were decided 2.5 months ago. That worked just fine for Taylor Griffin, U.S. House candidate and New Bern resident.
Well, it gave us a lot more time to do direct retail engagement with voters, for me to go knock on doors and actually meet voters in person and ask for their vote, to answer their questions.
Mr. Griffin is running for the second time to unseat Walter Jones, longtime 3rd District Representative, in the Republican primary. The district retained much of its territory it already had, and counties once shared with the 1st District, represented by Democrat G.K. Butterfield, now belong to it solely, and vice versa. The lines are clear, which makes work easier for Carl Mischka, chair for the Craven County Republican Party, after the primaries.
The most recent redistricting put all of Craven County in District 3, Congressional District 3, whereas part of the county had been in District 1, and that for the last number of years. It makes it easier for me to manage the Republican Party in Craven County because I don't have two districts that I have to interface with. It makes it easier for my precinct leaders to know where they're going to district meetings.
But, as is the case with most congressional elections, getting out the vote has been challenging. According to statistics from the State Board of Elections, average voter turnout in congressional-only primaries is under 15%. Mr. Mischka said this could be even worse with an unusual primary date.
The public is not aware as they could be. So what we're doing to combat that is using social media. I've funded robocalls. We are running ads in the Sun Journal, doing just about everything we can to make sure everybody knows there is a congressional and a judicial race on the June 7 ballot.
If longstanding voting patterns prevail, things will be even harder for Craven County Democratic Chair Bob Costanzo. Reliable Democratic blocs, including racial minorities and university students, are among the least likely to vote in congressional elections. The 3rd District is also among the most reliably Republican districts in the nation. Mr. Costanzo hopes to use the state's semi-open primary system to rouse interest in the Democratic candidates, David Hurst and Ernest Reeves, among unaffiliated voters. Reeves made an unsuccessful bid for Senate earlier this year.
We're working with our precinct chairs, and they are responsible for the areas that they control. We've encouraged them to go door-to-door, contact the registered voters in their area, and try to interest them in voting, especially to reach out to the unaffiliated to suggest that they should take a look at the Democratic candidates and possibly take a Democratic ballot.
But 2016 seems to be the year where anything is possible, and incumbents have an especially bright target on their backs. Populism is in vogue, and Jacksonville's Phil Law, a Republican also running to unseat Representative Jones, hopes a wave of voter frustration with the status quo will land him a place on Capitol Hill.
We see that with the rise of Donald Trump, this huge anti-incumbency wave. We're tired. We're fed up. Everybody needs to go.
Mr. Law also hopes he can develop a broad appeal for his platform, focusing on fiscal reform, immigration, and veterans affairs among those truly independent voters.
It's that sweet 10% that everyone is fighting for, and that will happen on every single race.
Even Representative Jones, who has been the 3rd District's representative for more than 20 years, concedes that old patterns probably won't factor into this year's elections. In the past, congressional candidates were often able to ride the coattails of popular presidential candidates due, in large part, to party affiliation.
I don't think there would be coattails. I do not. I think every one of us in the House, I can't speak for the Senate, we're going to have to run our campaign. If we have to run on our own, then it makes it much more difficult in the November election. My thinking and my hope is that we will come out of the convention in Cleveland and we will have a coordinated message that will excite the American people.
Keeping a united front will be a challenge for both major political parties, but North Carolina Republicans seem to be in especially dire straits in 2016. Unlike their shrewd operation, which helped them win control of the General Assembly and the Governor's Mansion in 2010 and 2012, respectively, the current NCGOP is without a clear chairman or a platform after their May 7 convention. Mr. Mishka said it was, quote, disheartening.
It was a non-event. My first-time attendees from Craven County kept looking at me saying, Carl, why are we here? You know, why are we spending days of our time, hundreds of dollars? We accomplished none of the delegates' business. Pure and simple, that's all there is to say about it. It was a disaster.
On the other hand, Mr. Costanzo says North Carolina Democrats are keeping tight ranks this year, a far cry from the sexual harassment controversies and in-house friction that plagued the party in 2012. State Democrats are scheduled to meet June 11 in Raleigh for their convention.
It appears to me that there is a lot of unity this year. We've got a good leader in Raleigh. Our chair there is excellent. We are meeting regularly, both in person and via a teleconference, and we have discussed many issues going forward, and I believe the state strategy will prove to be very successful going forward into this November election.
A lot of hype is reserved for presidential elections, especially in a state like North Carolina that may play a crucial role in electing the Republic's 45th chief executive. But even a short glance at the news and the Constitution will make it abundantly clear that the president cannot get very far without a cooperative Congress. Though those races may not get banner headlines, a U.S. House representative is one of 434 voting members, they can make the difference between a successful or disastrous 4 to 8 years for the president-to-be and the nation as a whole. Early voting continues through Saturday, and Election Day is Tuesday. You'll be asked to show a form of national or state identification before receiving your ballot. Same-day voter registration is still available during the early voting period. I'm Chris Thomas.
With one primary behind us and another one to come this Tuesday, a look back now at a man with many primary and general election victories and one stinging general election loss to his name. Gary Pierce served as chief aide to four-term Governor Jim Hunt during his final two terms. He wrote an authorized autobiography of his old boss long after Hunt's political wars were over. George Olson spoke with Gary Pierce and has this, which originally aired in November 2010.
Gary Pierce didn't wake up one morning with the sudden urge to see his name in print again.
Well, the main reason was he asked me to, but I was happy to do it.
That was all the reason he needed to begin work on the simply entitled Jim Hunt, a Biography. Pierce and Hunt have a long history. Pierce was covering state government and the legislature for the Raleigh News and Observer when he first met Jim Hunt when Hunt was running for lieutenant governor in 1972. During the years between that first introduction and Hunt's first gubernatorial campaign, Pierce got to know Hunt and decided to make the jump from political reporter to political insider.
By then, I had sort of reached a point where I started out thinking newspapers, journalism, what I wanted to do all my career. But I really liked politics, and I was getting to the point where I wanted to have a chance to be inside the room, making decisions, making things happen, rather than being outside the room trying to find out what happened.
Then Lieutenant Governor Hunt offered Pierce a job with his gubernatorial campaign, and what Pierce thought would be an interesting year turned into a 35-year association. Pierce will tell you that in writing this biography, he wasn't an unbiased observer. In fact, it's in print, second paragraph of the author's note. So writing a biography as compared to a hagiography was a difficult task.
One thing I did to prepare myself was I read a lot of authorized biographies, which this is, and it bothered me that so many of them seemed to lose credibility just because they seemed to be guilty of hero worship. And people may think my book is guilty of the same thing, but I tried very hard not to. I mean, I have a very favorable view of Jim Hunt and his impact on the state, and I know that comes through the book. But he wasn't perfect. He made his share of mistakes.
Most of the mistakes, according to the book, came in the famous U.S. Senate campaign that Hunt ran against incumbent Senator Jesse Helms, though the book waffles a bit on what those mistakes were. Should the campaign have gone further in its negative attacks on Senator Helms, or did the negative attacks that were made come back to bite them? There's no definitive answer given, nor could there be, but it led to the one political defeat in Hunt's career. The effectiveness of the Helms campaign against him and the seeming ineffectiveness of Hunt's Senate campaign was summed up in this Election Day 1984 incident.
Hunt was a driven man with relentless energy. He had a burning desire to beat Helms, a two-time senator whom Hunt considered an embarrassment to North Carolina, a demagogue who pandered to the worst in people, an out-and-out racist, Hunt believed. Early in the morning on Election Day, Hunt was campaigning at precincts along Interstate 85 in the textile manufacturing counties near Charlotte. Jerry Falwell's Moral Majority was working hard there to reelect Helms and President Ronald Reagan. Buses from conservative evangelical churches were hauling in voters. In the past, Hunt had always done well in those blue-collar precincts. He knew they would be crucial this time. Outside one polling place, he greeted a young woman, prim and plain, who had her husband and two children in tow. He asked for her vote. She was polite, but told him, "I'm sorry, Governor Hunt. We like you, but we're voting for the Christian." And I think what happened in this particular incident is he realized, I have failed to let people know, and really people like me, who I really am. And that was a really galling failure. And then I think that on top of losing to Helms, somebody that he had so little respect for and felt was so wrong for the state, that clearly was the low point.
The Hunt-Helms battle chews up a pretty good portion of the biography, not too surprising given the intense national interest in the race at the time. But if Jim Hunt lost that race, he won others, most notably four terms as governor, and won smaller battles along the way, playing a hard-nosed political game if needed. Pierce recounted in the biography the governor's recollections of efforts to increase the gas tax back in 1980 in order to pay for repairs to a secondary road infrastructure that a private study said was crumbling.
The battle raged for 2 months. Hunt organized his own committee to support the legislation, which he dubbed the Good Roads Bill. The fight polarized citizens along party lines, which helped Hunt line up Democrats. He maintained later that he never promised a legislator anything for a vote. But he, Joe Pell, and John A. Williams, two of his key aides, made it clear that I had just been elected to my second term, Hunt recalled. I had some damn power, and we'd never had a second term governor before. And I wanted to be clear about how strongly I felt about it, and that we were counting the votes and we were counting our friends. If you want the governor's help, you'd better vote for that bill. And if you didn't, you were not a friend and you couldn't expect to get any help in return. In other words, we were counting votes and we were counting friends. That was it. You didn't vote against us on that bill. If you did, you needn't come back and see us.
Pierce says that incident showed how comfortable and confident Hunt was in exercising the powers of the governor's office, and it was a power he helped to expand by getting gubernatorial succession. He did it by choosing not to follow his predecessor's methods in trying to acquire succession.
One of the things Hunt did on succession was he realized that all the governors before, they were trying to sound sort of holier than thou about it, so they would say, well, I'm for gubernatorial succession. But, oh, no, I don't want it to apply to me. I want it to apply to my successor. Well, then nobody really had a stake in pushing it through. What Hunt realized was the only way to get succession passed, because the legislature did not want it, the legislature didn't want a strong governor, was to give his supporters across the state a reason to be for it. And he had an enormous, deep network in every county of the state. Back then, that's a lot of how politics was done, and he had built the best organization. So he said, all right, I'm going to be for succession, but I want it to apply for me. And so that famous, powerful Hunt network had a reason to fight for it, and it was a close fight. It was a tough fight in the legislature, and then it was a tough fight getting it passed in a statewide referendum, but he got it done.
Getting a gas tax passed and gubernatorial succession were among achievements in his first 2 terms, and then he was defeated in his bid for the U.S. Senate. But he came back 8 years later to win 2 more terms as governor, where he pushed many education initiatives, the one in praise in some circles as America's education governor. Hunt's ability to come back from his 1984 Senate loss might be what most impressed Gary Pierce. He said he's seen some politicians suffer defeat and never really get over it. But Hunt got back to work, closing out his second term by pushing through a deal giving land to NC State University for what ultimately became their Centennial campus, then moved into the private sector for 8 years before coming back in 1992 to win a 3rd term as governor. Pierce ascribes Hunt's successful second act to a trait he says is not seen in all politicians.
There are a lot of politicians, and Lord knows I've known a lot of them in my years, who just want to be something. They want to hold an office. They want the glory. They want people to applaud and all that. Well, Hunt was really in politics because he wanted to do something, particularly education, economic development, more opportunities for people. And he was prepared to use every tool at his disposal to get it done.
Gary Pierce is the author of Jim Hunt, a biography, which is published by John F. Blair. I'm George Olson.
Former Governor Jim Hunt will speak next Friday, the 10th, at the New Bern Riverfront Convention Center as part of the Craven County Partners in Education Spring Luncheon.
I'm Byron Mumaugh, and here's what to look for in the Carolina skies this month. We're focusing on Mars. Mars has just reached opposition on May 22nd, which means it's now in its closest position for viewing, and it's an ideal time for us to observe. Let me open by quoting NASA for why we're so interested in Mars. Mars is a rich destination for scientific discovery and robotic and human exploration as we expand our presence into the solar system. Its formation and evolution are comparable to Earth, helping us to learn more about our own planet's history and future. Mars had conditions suitable for life in its past. Future exploration could uncover evidence of life, answering one of the fundamental mysteries of the cosmos. Does life exist beyond Earth? So for our own viewing this month, you're interested in where to look. If you go outside, just after sunset as it's getting dark, about 9 o'clock would be ideal, look in the southeast. Mars will be well positioned for viewing. It gets better and better until at midnight, it'll be positioned due south. Let's talk about what you can observe without using a telescope, especially if you're talking to your children and want to help them learn about it. Look at the brightness. Compare Mars and its brightness to Jupiter, which is now high in the west, and Saturn, which is just to the east of Mars. They're all easy to spot because they'll be the three brightest objects you'll see up there in the night sky. Look at the color. Mars appears orange. I know we always refer to it as being the red planet, but its true color is more orange, even when viewed through a telescope. And the reason for its color is its surface has a large amount of iron oxide, otherwise known as rust. Note also, when you're looking at Mars, and you want to be sure you're looking at actually Mars and not one of the nearby bright stars, planets don't sparkle. It has a steady image. Let's do a brief comparison of Mars to planet Earth. It's about half the diameter of Earth. Its axis tilt is similar to Earth's axis tilt, and that gives it seasons, just as the Earth has seasons. Its year is almost twice as long as Earth's year. The day on Mars is also similar length to the day on Earth. A Martian day is 24 hours and 37 minutes. In terms of distance from the Sun, we know that Earth is 93 million miles from the Sun, and Mars is 142 million miles from the Sun, so it receives less solar energy, and thus we can expect it to be cooler than the Earth. A warm summer day there would be 68 degrees Fahrenheit, but in winter it can drop down to below 200 degrees Fahrenheit. In terms of gravity, as I mentioned, it's half the size of Earth, and therefore its gravity is much less, about 4/10 of Earth's gravity. Thus, a person who weighs 100 pounds on Earth would only weigh about 40 pounds on Mars. Its atmosphere is different than Earth's. Its atmosphere is about 90% carbon dioxide, and it's very, very thin. Compared to Earth's, Earth's atmosphere is 100 times more dense. So even though you're standing in a hurricane-force wind on Mars, you're not feeling much pressure because the atmosphere is so thin. Now, some of the interesting features on Mars. Mars has the largest volcano in the solar system, Olympus Mons. Olympus Mons is 370 miles wide and about 17 miles high. For comparison, Mount Everest is only about 6 miles high. So Olympus Mons is nearly three times higher than Mount Everest. And if you sat Olympus Mons over the state of Arizona, it's so wide it would cover the entire state of Arizona. We're learning more and more Mars information all the time, so I encourage each of you to go out and observe Mars, which is what we'll be doing tonight at the Time for Science Nature and Learning Center in Grifton. I'll be giving an indoor presentation about planet Mars, and afterwards, the Carolina Skies Astronomy Club will have our telescope set up outside. Each of you will be able to view Mars through the telescopes, and also, at the same time, we'll be able to see Jupiter and Saturn.